Welcome to Shattering Myths. I am your host, Yada. Each weekday morning here on GCN, I strive to expose the beguiling and the destructive myths associated with religion and politics, with patriotism in the media, and with military and economic schemes. Instead of merely presenting the news, my mission is to help you understand what is occurring behind the headlines. Then during our second hour, we engage God on His terms by way of His one and only covenant and through His always dependable Torah teaching, so that with His guidance you will be able to replace your religion with reason and engage in a relationship. Our phone number for those who would like to participate in this program is toll-free, 877-300-7645. Yesterday, when the first half of our program ended, we were in the midst of an article on what is occurring in Syria. There were some more tidbits in that article that I thought were germane to our understanding, and so I'd like to continue with it. It is from the BBC. It continues with, although many countries backed Assad's opponents, few have actively, and where it reads actively here, it should actually read openly, supported arming the rebels, fearing that weapons might end up in the hands of hardline Sunni Muslim militants and lead to a repeat of Western conflicts, such as the wars against the Taliban in Afghanistan and Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups in Iraq. Now, of course, this is utterly stupid. The reality is that there was no Al-Qaeda presence of any kind in Iraq when we invaded. None. Absolutely none. Al-Qaeda only went into Iraq after the U.S. invasion. In fact, it even took them a couple of years after the U.S. invasion of Iraq before there was an appearance of Al-Qaeda. The President of the United States at the time, George Bush, King George II, of course, lied to the American people and said that he was invading Iraq because he wanted to go after Al-Qaeda there. Yeah. Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden were bitter enemies. They were not allies. As it relates to the wars against the Taliban in Afghanistan, the Taliban is an agency of the Pakistani government. We had provided arms to the Taliban for the express purpose of them fighting the Soviet-backed government. There, that was Zbigniew Brzezinski and Jimmy Carter who came up with that scheme. And, of course, it turned around to bite us because the United States armed its next enemy. So any time that you are supporting the troops and rallying around your government and saluting the flag, you need to know that some 1 million people who died in the various phases of the twin invasions of Iraq and the invasion of Afghanistan, 1 million people died as a result of those three invasions, that the United States armed not only Saddam Hussein, who we then decided we would call an enemy, but also we armed and equipped the Taliban, whom we decided to call an enemy. So the very weapons that were being wielded at the boys that we sent over there were American weapons. We manufactured the enemy that was killing Americans. I would not, if I were you, swear my allegiance, pledge my allegiance, or salute a government that does that to its children. Something to think about. This article continues to say, so far, the rebels have relied mainly, understand and underscore, mainly on light weapons smuggled from neighboring countries. Well, the mainly here is kind of like actively. It's a designed to distract you from the reality. It is probably true that less than half of the weapons aren't tanks, aren't artillery, aren't missiles or rockets. But light must also exclude 50 caliber machine guns, RPGs, and mortars because they are ubiquitous. But that is not to say that just because tanks, artillery, missiles, and large rockets comprise less than half of the armaments being wielded, that they don't represent a very substantial amount of these weapons. This is an all-out war, and these mujahideen are better armed than were the mujahideen in Libya. The only difference is that Libya was slightly more civilized, and we had more reporters on the scene, and therefore we were able to witness more pictures, if you will, and more video of the weapons that were being wielded against Muammar Gaddafi. And they were just this plethora of rockets and mortars and 50 caliber machine guns and even larger weapons mounted to the backs of trucks, all supplied by Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and others, including Sudan and the United States and Syria. The same thing has occurred. And it hasn't occurred because we are the West and the Islamic nations that are arming them are in love with democracy. They know that the people that they are arming are more opposed to democracy even than the dictator who sits in authority over that country. As a matter of fact, the two largest sources of arms, Saudi Arabia and Qatar, are in fact dictatorships. Assad's strongest regional support has been Shiite Muslim Iran. Well, that's only because they put in the term regional. Again, this article is being written for the express purpose of using qualifiers to mislead. Assad's strongest support has come from Russia. His second strongest supporter has been China. And Russia and China are supporting Assad because Russia and China do business with Iran. And Iran controls Syria. And the reason that this is being used as a proxy war with Europe and the United States on one side, China and Russia on the other, which is devastating in terms of its implications for the world going forward, but also with the Islamic world split between Sunni and Shias, is because of the United States invasion of Iraq. This is all a legacy of that. It would not, this civil war and its carnage would not have happened had it not been for the stupidity of America invading Iraq and giving Iraq to Iran. Changed the balance of power, which is why Saudi Arabia and Qatar are providing the weapons for the Sunnis to oppose the Shia. This next statement is, although Saudi Arabia and Qatar do not discuss specific weapon shipments to the rebels, both countries have been open about their support for arming them in principle. Saudi Foreign Minister Saad al-Fassil bluntly told a news conference in Riyadh on February 12th, quote, my country believes, by the way, his country is resolutely fundamentalist, Wahhabist Islam. They are Salafs. My country believes that the brutality of the Syrian regime. Now, mind you, there are few kingdoms on earth more brutal and more savage against anyone who threatens their dictatorship than the Saudi regime. My country believes that the brutality of the Syrian regime against its own people requires empowering the people to defend themselves. They have no interest in that. They're absolutely lying. They have zero interest in the people defending themselves. They turned what was a peaceful protest into a bloody civil war where 70,000 people at a minimum have been killed, 70,000 are missing, and hundreds of thousands have been raped because they wanted to destabilize what the Shias in Iran had accomplished there. Qatari Prime Minister Sheikh Hamad bin Jassim bin Jaber Al Thani, boy, that boy needs another last name, said last week that there is no clear international opinion to end the crisis. Oh, yeah, there is no clear international opinion to end the crisis in Syria. How could there not be? If there's anything that's clear, is that everyone in the world would like the crisis in Syria to end. So this boy needs an education, not another last name. The entire world wants it to end. There is just no way for it to end because Qatar and Saudi Arabia, the United States and Europe, have decided to turn what was once a Gandhi-like protest into absolute savagery. So he says, we are supporting the opposition with whatever it needs, even if it takes up arms for self-defense. There is no self-defense in the response being wielded by the Mujahideen in Syria. And every article that has been done on the Mujahideen and their relationship with Qatar has shown that one of the principal means to determine who gets the weapons is how fundamentalist their Islam happens to be. The more fundamentalist, the more terrorist oriented, the more jihadist the group in Syria, the more likely they are to get the Qatari weapons. Their litmus test is the opposite of that being deployed in the West. But the Qatari weapons, mind you, aren't Qatari weapons, they're American weapons, simply being distributed by stealth through a middleman. Western countries have been more cautious and have so far committed publicly to spending only, quote, non-lethal aid, like radios and body armor. You know, body armor may be non-lethal aid, but when somebody that is wearing the body armor is shooting a gun, it is equivalent to lethal aid. Radios may be non-lethal aid, but when they're used to coordinate attacks, they become lethal. It's the kind of thing that we did in the Sudan, Reagan being the most guilty. We supplied them with communications gear, with all sorts of transportation gear, so that they could more easily slaughter 3 million African animists and Christians, perpetrating the worst genocide in the last 20 years, all by supplying non-lethal aid. And by the way, that is an absolute lie. We just supply our lethal aid covertly. International powers are alarmed by the growing influence of Islamist hardliners in a country which lies at the crossroads of the Middle East between Iraq, Israel, Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan. There is nobody in the international community, by the way, that is alarmed by the growing influence. It's not a growing influence. It has been the same influence since the beginning. The opposition, when the opposition turned violent as opposed to peaceful, it was influenced exclusively. By exclusively, that might be a slight exaggeration. But it is in the 80%+ of those that are now wielding weapons against the Syrian regime that are not freedom fighters. They are, in fact, fundamentalist Islamic Mujahideen. They are jihadists. They are the very terrorists that America and the West says that they're at war against. And now we're arming them. Can you imagine the mess that will be Syria if they prevail? Shattering Mist. We're considering the situation in Syria. This story, though it is worded to mislead, nonetheless confirms everything that we have been talking about relative to Syria since the beginning of that conflict. It continues. It says one of the reasons for change in donors' minds, these are donors of weapons, is that they want to empower a new military command. So what the United States and Europe keep trying to do is to say, well, you know, I don't want to just send weapons to the only commands that exist within Syria now are Islamic terrorist organizations. And so if we create the illusion of a overall military command, like same thing that happened in Libya. In Libya, all of the fighters were members of various jihadist fundamentalist Islamic groups. And they were, of course, ruthless. And that's who we gave our weapons to. But we wanted this umbrella, the West wanted this umbrella to say, oh, we're really not arming terrorist organizations. We are instead providing weapons to an organized resistance. And so they create this illusion. That is what the West continues to try to do in Syria. It's just that the illusion has never been credible in Syria. Shouldn't have been credible in Libya. I mean, Libya now has become the arms bazaar for the jihadist world. It's why so many horrible things are occurring across northern Africa. So several fighters from across the country who spoke to Reuters said that they feared that the ultimate plan of outside powers was to push the what's called the Free Syrian Army, which is a complete myth. That's just that's like calling the Muslims who live in Israel Palestinians. they want to send them and other moderate Islamist fighters into confrontation with the radicals. Well, there is no such thing as a radical. There are only fundamentalists, and there has never been a moderate Muslim. If you are a moderate Muslim, a peaceful Muslim, you cease to be a Muslim according to the Quran, and fundamentalist Muslims, good Muslims, are ordered to kill you. So that might be the mindset of the West, but it too is absurd. Fighters from hardline groups such as Jabhat al-Nusra, which is the largest militant group fighting in Syria, and the Islamist Ahrar al-Sham, the second largest, have waged some of the deadliest attacks in Syria, including car bombings in Damascus, Aleppo, and elsewhere. Their suicide bombings have killed hundreds upon hundreds of people, but they're most known for their rapes. Their ranks have been swollen by jihadi fighters from around the Muslim world. Well, the first group came from Iran West, where the United States came up with the Awakening Councils, where we armed Sunnis to allegedly confront al-Qaeda. Well, it's those Sunnis that we armed that are now in Syria. They were the first to arrive. But then the Libyans arrived, fresh with all the weapons that the world was giving them. And soon it became the ultimate place for a Muslim boy to play jihad so that he would get the reward of the 72 virgins in Allah's paradise. And now a disproportionate number of the jihadists fighting the Syrian regime are simply jihadists from countries around the world. They are not Syrians. They are not fighting for their own country. The chief of staff of the rebel military command, Brigadier Salim Indris, said that the presence of foreign fighters was hindering international support for the battle against Assad. Quote, "We call all brothers from all the countries, please, my brothers, we do not need men. Stay in your own countries and do something good inside of your own countries. If you want to help us, just send us weapons or funding. And even pray for us." I love that. It's kind of like the tele-evangelist. He's going to say, you know, you need to send us money. You need to send us money. Oh, and by the way, you can pray for us, too. You do not have to come to Syria. We have enough Syrian men fighting. Actually, what he wanted to say, but he couldn't say, we have enough foreigners already here. Indris denied receiving weapons from donors and said the weapons are still entering through Syria through the black market, apparently reluctant to put any foreign powers in the spotlight. Quote, "We are not receiving weapons from the Europeans. We don't want to embarrass them. We do not want to embarrass anyone with the weapons issue." In other words, I'm not going to talk about who made these weapons that we are using, because the price that we're paying to get these weapons is to deny that they came from the United States and Europe through Qatar and Saudi Arabia. You know, if you can't tell the truth, if you're concerned that the truth will embarrass you, you ought not be doing what you're doing, which is the case here. And of course, these Syrian regimes now are being bribed to fight. There's $100 per month, which is a lot of money in that part of the world, being paid and weapons being given to those who are fighting. It is something we'll talk about when Shattering Myths returns. To Shattering Mist. I'm your host, Yada. You can engage in this discussion by calling 877-300-7645. The last two paragraphs of this story were chilling to me. I want to make a connection for you so that they are equally chilling to you. At the end of the Iraq War, the Iraq War, of course, is ongoing. Sunnis are continuing to kill Shias, and Syria is the legacy of the Iraq War. The United States came up with this unbelievably stupid idea of providing weapons and money to the Awakening Council. We realized that we had taken Iraq and we had broken it. We had given, taken away control from a secular dictator who empowered Sunnis over Shia, and we turned the country over to the mullahs in Tehran, And now we had Shias oppressing Sunnis. And we knew that we had made that mess because somehow nobody in the Bush administration could count. And therefore, we wanted to come up with a way to somehow create a bit of a stalemate because the Shia militias that were killing Americans turned on the Sunnis once the Americans huddled down in their camps and started murdering Sunnis. So the Bush administration came up with this harebrained idea that the solution to that was providing weapons, militia uniforms, and monthly stipends, about $100 a month, to Sunnis who would report to the Sunni warlords throughout Iraq. Now, here's what's happening in Syria now. Seeking to address the divisions, the military councils hope to pay fighters a symbolic monthly salary of $100, funded in part by donations from the Gulf. The Holmes commander said that one Gulf state had recently paid $15 million towards these wages. They want to organize the rebels and have them under one command. Who joins will be eligible to receive the money and the weapons, he said. It is all about organizational purposes. If a brigade joins, then they will take its share. If it doesn't, then no weapons. This is precisely what we did in Iraq. It has led to the deaths of thousands of people in these in the civil war that is brewing in that country, and it became the catalyst for the Syrian conflict. And now we're doing the same thing. We're encouraging payments to boys to go off and play jihad, and we're arming them, thinking that if we're supplying the money in the army, that they will listen to us and not to Allah. Speaking of listening, I received this letter a few days ago. Yada, I've been a listener of yours since 2009. I was deployed in Kuwait and in Iraq with the U.S. Army. And given the reality that the dangers of this job could get me killed, I decided to put an honest effort into finding God. For the first time, I sat down with an open mind and read through what's called, in quotes, the Holy Bible. What I found was that I couldn't make the Old and New Testaments agree. It was like there were two different gods involved, and I wanted to know why these two testaments did not agree. The only factor that played into this is that both of my grandfathers were Jewish, and though that didn't make me Jewish by rabbinical definitions, it did raise some questions about where I fit in concerning the law and the Gentile believers. It seemed that there were two types of Christians in the early days, Jewish ones who kept the law and Gentiles who didn't. Where did a half-breed like me fit into that picture? It was then that I found Yada Yah. I quickly, that'd be yadayah.com for those looking for the same source of six volumes. That's about 2,500 pages, a presentation of Yahweh's testimony, focusing mostly on prophetic testimony. We've been considering the opening volume of Yadayah in the second half of the program as we consider the prophetic nature of the creation account. So he said it was then that I found Yadayah. I quickly read every word and couldn't believe what I was learning. God has a name. I had been told it was God, Lord, Jehovah, Jesus, and every other idiotic man-made title. God hates religion. Wow, I had been told that he loved and cared for all true Christians. Then you expose the lies of Paul, and he revealed exactly why I couldn't get the two sides of the book to agree. I returned home from deployment as an expatriate, with a very different worldview. I promptly quit my church, and even though I'm still contracted with the military, I have a deep loathing for the organization. Last night I was talking to my brother, his name is Joshua, but that means it is Yahusha, on the phone, and he was telling me that he was suicidal. He hated life and he wanted to die. Over the course of our discussion, he admitted to me that he was hearing voices and seeing things and feared that he was schizophrenic. Then he told me that scratches were appearing on his back and that sometimes his mind goes blank. I started to tell him about Yahweh and that he needs to read and understand the Torah. It was at that point that the conversation took a bizarre twist. His voice changed into something I didn't recognize. He sounded extremely angry and then just laughed when I mentioned Yahweh. This is my little brother with whom I've had a close relationship over the years. He was screaming at me and wanted to kill me, and that I was going to die and enjoy dying, he said. He said that his name was Jezebel. His name was now Lucifer. And while I heard Joshua's voice again, he asked who he was talking about, and he didn't even know that he'd been talking to me. So his voice changed, identified the new voice, identified himself as Jezebel, as Lucifer, laughed at the name Yahweh, and then after a while, his voice returned to his own. My brother is not religious and would never consider himself, an atheist. So he considers himself an atheist, making himself vulnerable to this. This conversation was very out of sorts for him and it's worrisome for me. He said, the writer of the letter now says, I'm still very new to Yahweh. As a divorcee and former adulterer, I don't feel qualified to approach this. I don't think Christians can help, only Yah can. Do you have any advice, or can you lead me to Yahweh's advice concerning a matter like this? I really don't know what to do. I'll leave the man's name, even first name, anonymous. It was good to, I wrote him back, it's good to have you on this journey with me, my friend. We have both come a long way. Since you said that you were making an honest effort, I'm not surprised that you were troubled by the profound and irresolvable conflict between the Torah, prophets, and Psalms on one hand and the Christian New Testament on the other. Yahusha's words excluded from the New Testament encountered among Yahweh's, then the conflict continues. It is obvious to all but to those who are either ignorant of one or the other or blinded by religion that this is the case. By questioning Paul, I finally came to deal with this problem, as did you. Personally, I like the real God a lot better than the religious one. I am sure you do as well. I am thrilled that you returned an expatriate. When you have time, I'd love to know the reasons why this also occurred. My hope is that you have continued on your journey by using introtogod.org as a tool. Turning to your question, Hasatan is real, as are his demons. And if Yahusha's testimony in Matanyah 8 is accurate, they can possess and they can be driven out. Unfortunately, the earliest witnesses to Matanyah 8 are post-Constantine and thus not remotely reliable. And I'm not an expert on demon possession. From your testimony, I think that your brother, however, may be in serious trouble. This is exactly as I would have expected things to play out. Possession, desire for death, your witness in Yahweh's name, and Satan's angry reply. But again, I'm basing this on Matanyah 8, which is not necessarily credible. You have asked me a question that I'm not qualified to answer. Everything I know about Yahweh and the path to him is contained in yadayah.com or introtogod.org. And I have not yet confronted anything of this sort in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. And since the Torah does not provide an answer for this, I don't have one. Other than to say, where Yahweh is, Satan is not. That said, Matanyah 8 follows the Sermon on the Mount, where Yahusha affirmed the Torah. So the circumstances are similar to your own with your brother, as was his demonic response. So if I were in your shoes, I'd go to your brother and demand in Yahweh's name that the demon leave him. Barring that, I'd devote all of the time you can to teaching your brother what you have learned about Yahweh, his covenant, his Torah, and his invitations. If he comes to know him and understand what he is offering, he'll be in a position to respond. At that point, Satan becomes powerless in your brother's life. I'm sorry that I don't have a direct answer from the Torah to share, but based upon what I know of the Torah, its covenant, and its invitations, especially its God, the best possible outcome is obtained by sharing the Torah and Yahweh with your brother. Please stay in touch. Write me again when you're able. I've attached a Word document of an introduction to God. It is the best tool I know to share the Torah and its covenant in Yah's name. This man wrote back the following day. I do like, he says, the real God better than the religious one, since he uses knowledge, example, and powerful action to inspire people, much like a good human leader does. The religions of the world can do nothing but scare a person into submission or numb the mind to the point of idiocy. You know, that's it's an interesting statement, but if I might comment here. When you actually come to know God as he is, as opposed, and you distance yourself from the religious caricatures of God, the real God is really a neat individual. I mean, rather than asking you to believe in the unknown, he says, here's the knowledge, here's the information necessary to come to know. And knowing is so much better than believing. And he does lead by example. I mean, you can't look at what he did on Pesach and Matzah and Bukurim and Shavua as anything other than leading by example. What he did on behalf of his children, taking them out of the crucible of Egypt. He does inspire us, but he has no interest whatsoever in controlling us. It's the best of all worlds. The God who actually created the universe, the author of the covenant, the author of the Torah, is indeed lovable, worthy of your respect. We'll return to this letter when Shattering Myths returns after the break. Considering a exchange of letters. In fact, I have about a dozen letters that are queued up for future programs. If this is something that works for our listeners, in this particular letter, my friend wrote, "I learned to hate patriotism." Mind you, this is a man that has served tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan, and he wrote, "I learned to hate patriotism while deployed." For several reasons. First, before entering service, I was told by the media, by the political leaders, and by the community around me that we were helping the Iraqi people by ridding them of a cruel dictator. Our mission was just because we were bringing the people of the Middle East the same freedom that we enjoy. How could that be a bad thing? Well, when I got over there, I saw the destitute conditions of the people. Families living in the most pathetic circumstances you can imagine. A culture that seemed backwards in so many ways that, in my estimation, at the time, had to tie into this condition. As a result, I came to see Islam not as one of the great religions of the world, but as a sick cult that leads people into mass poverty. In a nutshell, I saw with my own eyes what I had been told was a noble cause was not. I still don't fully understand our rationale for invading Iraq, but I know it was not to liberate the Iraqis. The other big factor I saw was the attitude of our own U.S. military. In my thinking, there was no difference in the value in an Iraqi person's life or mine or yours. We are all valuable, wonderful, living creatures that should not be eradicated at the hands of cruel men. Whether it is a jihadist beheading an American or an American machine gunner ripping holes through a man's body, the destruction and waste of life is identical. However, the American soldier is trained to have an air of superiority. The enemy is a non-entity. He is not human. He is just a haji. And he ought to be killed. It was the attitude we had about all the people over there. I found it completely contradictory to the lesson of the Good Samaritan. To Yah's teaching about loving your neighbor as yourself, I came to see that it was American patriotism that was responsible for this stupid attitude. I chose to hate patriotism and the lying American government as well. My brother's phone has been shut off. It was shut off yesterday. I can't reach him. He has no email that I'm aware of, but at the first opportunity, I will personally introduce him to the Torah. Hopefully, Yahweh will do the rest. It is a difficult journey to begin, given the condition of the world around us, with the truth as a weapon, yet we might prevail. I responded, my friends, thanks for sharing this. Your reasons for becoming an expatriate are as I had expected. They are the only informed, rational response to the evidence, both the conditions in Iraq and those experienced under American command. You are informed and rational. With your permission, I'd like to share your letters anonymously during the Shattering the Show. Even more desirable, I'd love to have you as a guest on the show. As it turns out, he's working during this time and cannot do that. That's why I'm reading this letter. Either way, let me know how this works out with your brother. I'm not surprised that he has shut off his phone. I hope that you reach him before he injures himself, and I hope that he is receptive to the healing message you will be bringing with you. My experience is that no one is more open to Yah's truth in our world than atheists. Here's another letter. We're going to just get started on this. We'll probably carry this letter into another program. It's Yada. I heard you briefly address the Arian controversy in one of the archives. This is something I want to gain more information and understanding of. Would you be willing to devote some airtime to the Arian controversy and then also to line by line explain and or refute what is called the Nicene Creed? There is some truth within it, but also grave deception. My wife, all of my extended family, and all of the churches we have been part of hinge their belief on this creed. I think it would be appropriate to shatter it. What do you think? Well, we don't have much time to get too deeply into this, but let me share what I can. I will at least begin. The Nicene Creed is not the one, the actual Nicene Creed is not the one that is shared as the Apostles' Creed. The Nicene Creed was designed principally to eradicate the Arian controversy. And as it turns out, with the time that we have remaining, this is a topic that we will pick up in our program. Not tomorrow, because tomorrow we'll have IQ al-Rasuli, but hopefully on Monday. But stay with us, because we're going to turn to Yah's testimony in just a moment.
Hi, I'm Dr. Joel Wallach, the Dead Doctors Don't Lie guy. There's no reason why you shouldn't live to be at least 100 and have a great time getting there. And I'm going to give you a free copy.